the Middle East portion of Anchorage brings up. From Anchor Homes, let me rephrase that, with all due respect. Right. Precisely the point here with this bill, Mr. Speaker, is that I don't think we need to talk about something. What we need to do here, what this bill does, is create an alternative form of an insurance policy to be underwritten that makes health care insurance more affordable. That's the central number one issue to every American in this country today. How can they afford to pay for their health insurance coverage for themselves and their family and their children? Mr. Speaker, this only relates to individual policies. I agree this is somewhat experimental, but sending a message, that's what this bill does. It sends the message to the people in the insurance community and to the consumers of the state that the legislature is trying to do something about containing health care costs. Mr. Speaker, that's what we're doing here. We shouldn't fear some change. I do not support this amendment.
Representative Harris.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I rise in opposition to the amendment as well and want to echo the words of the sponsor of the bill, that what it seems to me like, this is pretty self-explanatory, that if you're trying to give some options to people out there, individuals trying to get individual and health insurance, or that they don't have to partake in all the different types of coverages that are out there, and they will know that when they sign on to the individual health care coverage. And the insurance companies, if they know they're not going to be responsible for this, that, and the other type of coverage, can offer it for less. They don't have to be responsible for as much. And the member still can, the person still can get optional coverage if they so choose, and understanding that the policy will probably cost them more money. But it's an individual option type situation, and I think this amendment takes away that option. And I don't want to do that. I think that the sponsor of the bill has done a very good thing for individual members out there in the estate trying to get affordable health care insurance. So I support, I oppose the amendment, and we'll support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Harris. Representative Lynn.
Yes, I also rise in opposition to the amendment. Actually, what we have here is a pro-choice bill. You can choose this, or you can choose that, or you can choose the other. Some people think that pro-choice is good. Obviously, it must depend on what the choice is. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Minority Leader.
I stand for pro-life now, Mr. Speaker. I want to go back to just that one particular point I raised about the choice of dental care provider. And my friend, the rules chair, said that in 2107, there were protections that would preclude insurance companies from dictating the choice of health care provider. I have been unable to find that protection when it's afforded to an individual. The requirements of 2107.010, patient and health care provider protection, relate to contracts between participating health care providers and managed health care entities that offer group managed care plans. 2107.020, a group managed care plan must contain the following. So I don't see the protections that in 2107.030, choice of health care provider, if a managed care entity offers a group health plan, I don't see where the protections are afforded to individual purchasers of insurance. So if he can point out the portion in the statutes which he crafted, and I probably voted for, reluctantly, but I probably voted for, I'd be most happy.
Thank you, Mr. Minority Leader. Is there further debate? Representative Katula.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I didn't hear this bill, and certainly not my area of expertise, but I see two fundamental flaws in it, and that's the amendment will address specifically. First, I don't see any promise that premiums are going to go down by doing this. And I don't think that insurance companies have always lived up to what they have said that they will do that way. Second, and right to the heart of this, this puts people in a Hobson's choice situation. You want insurance, so you start doing away with the kinds of protection that you need and that you deserve. These are precisely the kinds of things that we in this body have said insurance companies will provide for. We shouldn't be putting individuals in the situation of needing that health care but deciding, well, maybe I can do without a mammography, or maybe I can do without that prostate screen, or maybe I don't need that diabetes screen, or maybe I don't need the test that will tell me if I'm pregnant that I'm going to have, you know, do terrible things to my children. I mean, this is a really important choice we're making here. If we back off on this, we are going to put people in a choice of doing without, when really what we should be working on is keeping this in place and working on the costs. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Representative Curtula. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Yes, I was in committee that heard this bill. The thing that makes the most difference of all the costs on this is 42365, which is substance abuse treatment coverage. And the problem is with people not being able to afford health insurance, if they are not substance abusers, they are paying a high premium to cover another group of people who are not even in a group, because all individual policies are mandated to have this coverage. And if we want to allow people to be able to buy coverage at an affordable price, they need to be able to figure out what things they can do without. And personally, I think I could do without midwife coverage, and I could also do without this provision, which would lower the insurance costs. And so I'm opposed to the amendment.
House, please come back to order. Representative Rogeberg.
Speaker, I'd like to set the record straight. As much as I hate to do this, but I will, and I do because of who I am and how I operate. I want to concede a point made by the minority leader as to my own authorship, that he is correct in terms of the interpretation of AS 2107. It does only apply to groups, not to individuals. So I will concede him the point. I will not concede him the amendment, however. And I would like to point out that the issue that relates to the dental section that he was using as an example, what that says in the law is right now the mandate is you just have to offer it. They don't have to take it now anyway. So it's already an optional thing. It's merely an offering. So this is not, I mean, I don't believe his argument holds up under those grounds if you analyze the particular statute that we are disallowing under this as a mandate. The mandate is only to offer the availability. So I would ask that the members reject this amendment and accept the concept of going forward with a new concept of delivering more affordable quality health care to Alaskan citizens.
Further debate on amendment number 2. Representative Hines.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I have not heard this bill either, but I have a concern that I'd like to ask the sponsor. That do we have any assurances that there will be a reduced rate?
Representative Rogeberg.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This always happens under second, what should happen under third, but let me just answer the question. There is a letter from Premier of Blue Cross Washington Alaska in your file indicating at the request, my request, and actually request the members of the Health Committee to see what the actual dollar savings would be. Because of the high cost of actuarially determining a precise amount, we did get a reply from them dated on May 5, which is in your packet, indicating that similar actuarial studies undertaken in the state of Washington under a similar legislation realize the savings as much as 20%. So that's the only empirical evidence I have to go on right now. We're not sure exactly what the scoping is, but I'm very pleased to see that in one instance in this country, it reached that high a level. Now, I'm not so optimistic it would otherwise, particularly because what we have to understand is this is optional. And certainly, like mammography, PSA, cervical cancer, those particular provisions would almost certainly be offered and accepted by anybody that would undertake an individual policy anyway, because these companies know that those provisions actually save them money in the long run. but not all the rest of it. So I hope that answers your question.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I think we have to really see why this part of this bill is there, and to take it out would destroy a huge part of the reason that the bill is there to begin with. We need this because what the whole purpose is we want to be able to make affordable health care to many people in this state. There are a lot of different options in that part of the bill that offer people opportunities to be able to get their health care at a cheaper rate because they don't need. My husband and I are past the childbearing rate age. I don't need to have that part of the coverage in my policy. So if it was me, I would be glad to be able to not have to worry about paying for the parts of the insurance that I don't need. And this is what this is doing. This is enabling people to be able to get health care coverage at a cost that they can afford. If we had all this in and said it was all mandated, it would be so prohibitive that nobody would be able to afford it. So this is what we're talking about. This destroys the bill.
Representative Cisna.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. I know that I have spoken before. The mention of the Premera Blue Cross Blue Shield letter and my effort to try to find that letter, both before this floor session, the information only just came to us. We asked for it in committee. That information about the savings were not forthcoming then, and this letter is dated May 5th. And other members may have looked for it in their packets and not found it. I found it was upside down, so you wouldn't have seen it because it was upside down, and you may want to look for it now, knowing that you have to turn your packet upside down to find it. It does compare Alaska to Washington State. Now, I have had occasion to spend some time getting to know Washington State's health care plans and talk to a number of people in Washington State about their health care. I would not find them comparable to Alaska. They have systems that we don't have. They're a much older state. They have county systems. They have HMOs. They have government facilities. They have a whole different kind of health care available to their public. So comparing us to the state of Washington is not enough. I think it's one little piece of information, but it's not enough. And the kinds of things that have been mentioned to me, the adverse selection, the fact that perhaps individual policyholders will say, I can save money now, and choose to eliminate some of those mandates that are there because this legislature through the years has decided they're really good things, just as the sponsor said. So I continue to feel that we don't have enough information. Great idea, but we don't pass every great idea in this body. And if we were passing them for campaign brochures, we'd pass everything, I'm sure. But that's not what our process is for. It's to make sure that we craft those good ideas into things that are good solutions. Thank you.
Again, we are debating amendment number 2. Would ask members to reel their thoughts in if it does not correspond to this amendment. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I rise to speak on this amendment because I'm hoping we don't have to get to the next amendment. And now the mention has been made of this, the letter from Premera Blue Cross. It does raise some questions. The amendment would retain insurance coverage for people who come down with diabetes, for people who can prevent the occurrence of breast cancer by getting a mammogram, by people who can prevent the occurrence of prostate and cervical cancer by getting screening. At some point, this legislature came in and said, those are things we want to do. We want to do everything we can to prevent breast cancer. We want to do everything we can to prevent cervical and prostate cancer. We want to do everything we can to help people with diabetes. And the Premera letter underscores, I believe, a question that was asked in the committee hearings on this bill. And though, as an aside, I do want to say that the sponsor of this bill has been incredibly gracious in spending time talking about this bill with members who had concerns. And I think it's a well-motivated bill for all the reasons the sponsor stated. But the question that was asked by Republicans and Democrats in the committees over and over and over again was, how much money will this save? If it's a dollar, I don't want it. If it's a lot of money, maybe I do want it. And the only response we've gotten was after the committee's hearings were done with, nobody did anything wrong in this regard, but after the committee hearings were done with, we got a letter from Premier Blue Cross. All it says is that Washington has different mandates than the state of Alaska does. And when we factored in their mandates, we determined that their mandates may account for 20% of the cost of insurance in Washington. Well, are their mandates the same as our mandates? Are they much broader than our mandates? And actually, I don't believe the Premier even says that if they took those mandates out, they would reduce people's health insurance premiums by 20%. They don't go that far. There's no promise that they would do that. They just say that that's 20% of the cost. They're not saying that they would reduce the cost by that much if people took those mandates out. But that's Washington. We don't know what mandates we're talking about. This is Alaska, and it's a smaller pool of people, and the mandates are different. I could see taking out some of the mandates for acupuncture treatment. I guess I don't want to pay for somebody else's acupuncture treatment, so I could see that. But I do want to pay for somebody else's breast and cervical cancer treatment and screening. So until we know how much money we would save consumers by taking this coverage away, I don't think it's a good idea to take it away. I don't even know if I would agree that it would be a good idea to take it away if we did know how much money it saved. We also have a debate about actuarial concepts that I think are beyond me and maybe beyond maybe a few other members of this body. I'm not so sure, but they are beyond me. But if we do this, if we let people opt out of coverage so that very few people are choosing, let's say, alcohol and drug abuse coverage, then those people who do check the box and say, I do want alcohol and drug abuse coverage, are probably going to have to pay a huge amount of money for that coverage, because the insurance companies are going to look at people who select coverage for particular problems and say, if you're selecting this coverage, maybe you're going to need it. Maybe you know something that we don't. Maybe you know that in your history, the history of your family, there is a history of alcoholism, and you suspect that maybe someday you'll need it. So we're going to charge you a lot of money. You're a high risk to us. You're a high risk to us if you select mammography coverage. You're a high risk to us if you select cancer coverage. And so what we'll do is, by saving an undetermined amount of money, maybe almost nothing for those of us who opt out, we might be making insurance unaffordable, even more unaffordable for people who opt in. So the people, as it turns out, with the most serious problems, with the most serious health problems, who need the insurance most, may never be able to afford it now. Those are questions, I think, that needed to be addressed by somebody with actuarial experience in the context of the answer that we never got before in committee, which is, how much will this save and how much will this cost? How much will it save to the people who opt out? How much will it cost to the people who opt in? Without answers to those questions, we're shooting in the dark. So I do agree with the members on this floor who've said the obvious, which is, we have to come up with a way to reduce health insurance costs. And I probably could agree to excluding coverage for some of these conditions. Acupuncture treatment, I could agree to exclude. Cancer coverage and screening and treatment, I can't agree to withdraw. So I do hope that the members really think this through, and think through this question at least, which is, can you vote for a bill without this amendment that doesn't guarantee you any cost savings? Or should we wait and see what the cost savings are before we give away these rights? And I hope the answer people choose is the second one.
Representative McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'll be brief out of respect for the rules, Chairman. I've struggled with this bill myself, and we're speaking to the amendment, but just a little latitude that others have had. I've read this letter from Premier over and over and over again, and maybe brighter minds will prevail, but what it says is is that they're not sure there's going to be any savings, not sure anybody's going to take advantage of it, but they're convinced that it'll send a clear message that consumers need relief from rapidly escalating health insurance premiums. And, Mr. Speaker, I guess I'm trying to understand who that message is going to be received by. Is it people who are going to read the paper that hear this bill passed, or is it consumers, or is it insurance companies? And, Mr. Speaker, I'm convinced it's the latter. And the reason that I support this amendment is that you know, there's always arguments for whether the government should interject itself into private industry, and I have made arguments in other areas that they shouldn't. But when it comes to the insurance industry, Mr. Speaker, I think there is clear evidence across the nation that the government ought to interject itself into it. You know, the problem, Mr. Speaker, is that if you're an insurance company, why would you offer coverage for mammograms? Why would you offer screening for prostate cancer? Why would you offer mammograms if you don't have to? You know, you've got people who are at their most vulnerable. They need health care protection. They know it. They're going to pay to receive it. And if you're the insurance company reaping in the premiums, why offer a very expensive coverage when you don't need to? When you know that you're still going to get that person to pay for coverage no matter what? Because most people, Mr. Speaker, don't want to go without health insurance. My concern is that the message this bill will send will be a message, and it will be received by the insurance companies, and it will be a message that says that this legislature doesn't take seriously the mandates that we have put in place. I remember the now U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski's bill regarding diabetes coverage. And when she rolled out that bill, Mr. Speaker, there were alarming statistics about insurance companies failing to offer treatment to patients with diabetes. And those statistics were nationwide. And so there was a need for this legislature to interject itself into this particular industry to say, no, it's not right. You're going to offer that treatment. And so the message that this bill sends without the adoption of this amendment is we don't take the mandates that we have debated on and voted for and been signed into law seriously. Wave them in, wave them out. Whatever the cheapest cost is for us to continue doing business. And I really, Mr. Speaker, as you know, I'm a child of a medical family, and I have quite a bit of experience dealing with insurance companies, and I will tell you they will offer the least amount of coverage at the highest premium every single day of the week. And without us being here as watchdogs for the citizens in our districts to help make sure, to help tilt the scales the other way, people aren't going to get good health care coverage in the state. So I urge the members to support.
Thank you, Representative McGuire. Further debate. Representative Roper.
Mr. Speaker, I find it interesting that the member from District 23, I wasn't sure about what was testified to in the committee or not being in committee. I'm not sure I saw him there. But the point in fact is there was great debate about that, and an explanation of how the underwriting community and insurance companies approach individual policy underwriting as opposed to group underwriting. And they how that works, there's a huge distinction in this state about, and in most regulatory jurisdictions that allow insurance underwriting of individual policies to be discrete and relate directly to that individual as opposed to a group. A group in the state of Alaska has what's called guaranteed issue. You have to bring and allow people to come into that group. You don't with an individual. So as an individual, you currently can underwrite a policy tailored to that particular individual if you so desire to offer that product. But you can also adjust the premiums and so forth to the experience of that particular individual. That's why individual health insurance costs are higher than group costs. And what the problem is, what this bill is seeking to do is lower that cost, because most people in group plans have some contribution on the part of their employers to help them pay their costs, just like we do. But if you're an individual out there, you have none. And the premiums are higher because you can design these policies to fit the individual. And that's the testimony in the committee. That's on the record. And that's how it works in this state. So what we're doing in this bill is removing it through the amendment, Mr. Speaker. What we're doing is merely removing those legislative mandates to help lower the cost down as relate discreetly to a particular individual policy that can be underwritten individually. So there's a big confusion here. You have to understand the distinctions between individual policies and group policy and how they're put together and how they're priced. Because when you spread that all out, when we're spreading out here, the individual plans don't spread it to another individual plan like a pool. They're not in a pool. That doesn't lower the costs like it does in a group to lower those premiums down when they spread it around. Individually, they write the policy. What about your pre-existing conditions? They'll write around that, but they'll may, if you're lucky, they'll may write you a policy. This is a crisis in this country. We've got to use innovative ideas to try to overcome these to make insurance more affordable to people. And the way the regulatory structure is here now, the individual plans are written discreetly. But who came in and interrupted that? We, the legislature, did that. So we have gotten in the way of underwriting principles by making mandates. All this bill simply does is remove those. And incidentally, Mr. Speaker, as relates to diabetes training, it's only the diabetes treatment. This doesn't take away diabetes treatment, only the training mandate for the training if you become diabetic. Just a point of fact. Mr. Speaker, I still oppose this amendment.
Further debate. Are you ready for the question? Question being, shall the House adopt Amendment number 2? Members may proceed to vote. Clerk, lock the roll. Does anyone wish to change their vote? Clerk, tally the board.
10 yeas, 26 nays.
So Amendment number 2 has failed to pass the House. Madam Clerk.
Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Jorlier.
Mr. Speaker, we had one of our members have to go home ill, and Mr. Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent that Representative Croft be excused from the call of the House for the remainder of the day.
Without objection, due to illness, Representative Croft will be excused from the call of the House. Madam Clerk, do we have additional amendment?
I have no further amendments.
Number 1.
Okay. Amendment number 1 by Representative Garrett to page 1, line 13.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Before I move amendment number 1, there's, I suppose I have to do an amendment to the amendment. There's a wording problem, so.
Can you?
I move amendment number 1 first.
There is an objection. Representative Gira.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Let me explain amendment number 1 first, and then I'll deal with the stylistic change. And I've discussed this with the sponsor of the bill, and I believe he's supportive. We had the debate about what forms of coverage we should provide to people, what forms of coverage we should let people opt out of. My concern is that before we let somebody buy an insurance policy that doesn't cover important health issues like mammograms, breast and cervical cancer screening, prostate cancer screening, before we let people opt out of something like that, we have to make sure they know they're opting out of it. As we know, with big contracts, insurance contracts, contracts from all sorts of large companies. The contracts are sometimes 20, 30 pages long. It could say under this bill as written that you're not covered for these very important things and a consumer would never know it. So if we're going to let consumers opt out of coverage for very important treatment issues and health care concerns, we should make sure they know they're opting out. So what amendment number 1 does is says that on a separate document, a consumer must be advised that they are opting out of mammography coverage or breast and cervical cancer screening coverage. It's just fair notice to a consumer who's going to make this choice. Before we have a vote on this amendment, I would move an amendment to amendment number 1.
Object to hear what the amendment to the amendment is.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you for helping me through this. The amendment to amendment number 1 would take out the words insert new section 2 and renumber, and then take out the words section 2, and it would just insert the remainder of this amendment, starting at the word coverage, ending at the word withheld. It would just insert that at the end of page 1, line 12, and make it part of the new 2151-350. So the amendment to the amendment would say, would insert Was that clear? Should I do that again?
Do it again.
Thank you. So what I'm proposing to do under the amended amendment number one, the amendment to amendment number one, would be to delete the words insert new section 2 and renumber, delete the words section 2, and then the intent would be to insert the remainder of that language after the words optional coverage period on page 1, line 12.
Does everybody understand the amendment to the amendment? Page 1, line 12, the language will be inserted. Is there an objection to the amendment to the amendment?
I think I'm not going to object, but there's a matter of cleaning up some additional wordage, so I wanted to make sure that the maker of the amendment to the amendment included the additional words, because we can't amend it in the third degree, I don't believe.
That's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And the sponsor and I also agreed that a few extra words that I didn't write down, but I wrote down on the sponsor's version, would be inserted. So as part of amendment to amendment number one, if I could ask the sponsor to read the additional words that I would like to add.
Mr. Speaker, as much as we can't amend the amendment to the third degree, I'd suggest that the member from District 23 add the words after a separate document, adding the words during the application process.
Mr. Speaker, the remainder of the amendment to amendment number one would be to insert the words during the application process after the words on a separate document. So it reads, on a separate document during the application process, acknowledging that the coverage will be withheld.
Okay. Does everyone understand the amendment to the amendment? Is there objection? Hearing no objection, the amendment to the amendment has been adopted, which brings us back to amendment number one as amended. Is there objection to amendment number one as amended? No objection. Without objection, then amendment number one as amended is adopted. Madam Clerk, are there further amendments?
I have no further amendments.
Mr. Majority Leader.
Mr. Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent that the committee substitute for House Bill 95, Labor and Commerce amended, be considered engrossed, advanced to third reading, and placed on final passage.
There is an objection. I ask the members to retain their packets for tomorrow's calendar. Madam Clerk, would you please read the next item on today's calendar?
House Bill 243 by the House Rules Committee by request of the Governor titled An Act Establishing State Agency Program, Performance Management, and Audit Powers in the Office of the Governor for the Evaluation of Agency Programs and Providing for an Effective Date. The State Affairs Committee considered the bill, recommends it be replaced with Committee Substitute for House Bill 243, State Affairs, recommending due pass Seaton, Dahlstrom, and Weirach. No recommendation, Berkowitz. The report was signed by Weirach Chair. Finance Committee considered the bill, recommends it be replaced with Committee Substitute for House Bill 243, State Affairs, with the same title, attached to zero fiscal note, recommending due pass Meyer and Williams. No recommendation, Stoltz, Jewell, Croft, and Moses. The report was signed by Williams, co-chair. There's one committee substitute.
Mr. Majority Leader.
I move and ask unanimous consent that the State Affairs Committee Substitute for House Bill 243 be adopted in lieu of the original bill.
Without objection, the State Affairs Committee Substitute is adopted and before us in second reading. Madam Clerk, do you have amendments?
I have no amendments.
In that case, Mr. Majority Leader.
Mr. Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent that the committee substitute for House Bill 243, State Affairs, be considered engrossed, advanced to third reading, and placed on final passage.
Without objection, we have the bill on third reading. Madam Clerk, would you please read the title for the third and final time?
CS for House Bill 243, State Affairs, entitled An Act Establishing State Agency Program Performance Management and Audit Powers in the Office of the Governor for the Evaluation of Agency Programs and Providing for an Effective Date.
Under debate, Representative Hawker.
Mr. Speaker, this is a delightful little bill. This bill directly addresses one of my favorite subjects, and that is improving the accountability of government. Specifically, this bill would authorize and establish within the Office of Management and Budget, the ability to perform program audits, internal audits, of executive branch agencies. This internal audit function is something that, frankly, I think is long overdue, well needed here. We've had a legislative budget and audit function. You know, and our mission has been to pursue and improve government accountability, issues that we're highly concerned over. This function gives the executive branch its own authority to conduct its own internal examinations, its internal audits of the affairs of government over which it has authority. Very, very similar to the one of the most important functions that exists in any large corporate structure, that of the internal auditor. The bill goes on to protect, and I believe appropriately, and it's been the subject of some discussion, extended discussion, about the level of confidentiality to be maintained over the records and the source documents that will be used in these examinations and audits. I believe that's been worked out to the satisfaction, at least to the acceptable level of the various parties concerned that have been involved in that debate. And again, in the interest of improving, significantly improving the accountability of government, giving the executive branch the ability to delve within itself to find those matters that it feels it can improve its own accountability, I'd ask for the passage of this bill. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Hawker, Mr. Minority Leader.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. I apologize for rising so much, but if members would note the board, there's just not a lot of minority members left, so. I feel a little bit like the postman, you know, neither rain nor sleet. We're still here. This bill went before a committee I appeared on and or work with, and I want to thank Mr. Hogan from OMB for all the hard work that he's put into this. It's really been remarkable, and he deserves kudos from us and from the administration. I had some concerns, which have not been completely addressed, but for the most part have, about the confidentiality of work and information that is part of these audits. I believe that as much disclosure as possible is in the public's interest, and we were able to craft language that got us most of the way to the place where I was most comfortable. So. That said, the substance of the bill is as good, I think, as we can get to. It is somewhat problematic to me that funding for positions that are necessary for the audit are going to come from the Division of Elections and the Human Rights Commission, and that to me seems inappropriate. It seems we ought to advance the cause of audit without diminishing the cause of elections and human rights.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Minority Leader, Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I didn't have the opportunity to sit on a committee that heard this bill, but I do have a question and a concern, and I'm wondering if I can get an answer. How is this new internal audit process going to work in conjunction with or outside of or its relationship with the current missions and measures that the state does?
Representative Wyrock.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The concern in state affairs where the last section of this bill was worked over, in fact, the last sentence is where most of the focus was on during state affairs, was to ensure that the legislative budget and audit function of our independent branch of government could proceed with its analysis and review and necessary functions and not have any conflict from reviewing materials that it otherwise would have access to for the benefit of the public and the legislative branch. Tangentially in response to the previous speaker's question, this is intended to assist the executive branch in performing its audit functions while not keeping from the legislature its necessary audit function and to remove the potential tension that may result in litigation over whether or not it would have access to documents and records to perform its services for us as legislators. So that's where we're coming from, and I want that clear on the record, too.
Thank you, Representative Wyrock. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Although I sit on the State Affairs Committee as well, I may have been ill at the time this bill was considered, and I'd like to ask a question to both the Minority Leader and the Chair of the State Affairs Committee. And if the members would take a look at the April 16th letter from the Department of Law from Jim Baldwin, the language I'm referring to in the letter is in the second paragraph, bottom of the first page. Under these circumstances, the work of the auditors, and that's what I'm focusing on, the work of the auditors would be subject to the deliberative process privilege. Then they cite the Capital Information Group case from the Alaska Supreme Court. However, unlike the unqualified privilege accorded to the legislature, the deliberative process privilege is qualified, meaning that it's determined by balancing the interests involved. And they're looking at, quote, the work of the auditors. Looking at the language that was added in State Affairs on page 2, lines 5 through 9, it looks like the only items that may be required to be divulged are documents, internal audit work papers, and other related supportive material containing information, etc. So it looks like the work of the auditors, which may include interviews with auditors and non-documentary or presumably electronically recorded items, are absolutely privileged. Am I wrong in that? I see people shaking their heads. Maybe we need to clarify the legislative history here.
Mr. Minority Leader.
Thanks very much. Mr. Baldwin's letter predated the version that's in front of us now. I felt, and I think the majority of the committee felt, that it was very important that we should have with an audit not only the conclusion but the footprints leading up to the conclusion, so people might review the audit, the information that led to the conclusion, and if the conclusion was not consistent with the footprints leading to the audit, then people reviewing it would be able to determine that. Going directly to what the representative from District 20 state, it's confidentiality only to the extent required by law applicable to the agency from which the material is or was obtained. That means if we're going into, for example, DFYS, or what the agency formerly known as DFYS, we're not going to make public the case files of individual cases that would otherwise be protected, but the quantum of information might be released as part of the audit. If we're talking about going into anything that related to the Department of Law or the Public Defender's Agency, we're not going to invade the attorney-client privilege, but we might take an aggregate look at what transpires within those agencies. So I have some comfort that we have minimized the amount of confidentiality in this bill to the amount that is minimally necessary. We could always go further. We could have said there's no confidentiality, which I think by default would have left it under the existing statutes. But I think we got there by using all this language.
Thank you, Mr. Minority Leader. Representative Wyrek.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I think for the benefit of the questioner on State Affairs, I can't recall whether you're there or not, but since this language that is in the bill before the House was discussed thoroughly in State Affairs, both by and the language by Mr. Baldwin in this letter was also addressed by Ms. Davidson, the legislative auditor, and by Mr. Hogan, and I would just refer and adopt by reference what we did in State Affairs that would accompany this through the legislative history so it's clear, because I think we did deal with that during State Affairs.
Representative Groomberg. House Standardese. House, please come back to order. We only have 21 here. Representative Kutula.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. May we revert back up the calendar
without
to
objection,
introductions?
Move up the calendar to introduction, I guess.
In the Paratrovich Gallery today is a constituent of mine who's very dear to me and who did a lot of great service to the state in this body, Ms. Connie Paddock. Connie was the chief clerk, sat here, and one of my father's as he had the honor of working with her. She served for 13 years, 5 and a half as chief clerk, and, you know, her stories are just amazing about the legislature, about certain individuals, those of us who grew up around these halls. She has some pretty fun stories. But, you know, Mr. Speaker, more than almost any legislator, I think it's people like Connie who really have served the state and seen it progress. So if you'd help me welcome Connie Paddock.
Further guests? Seeing none, prior to the Eddies, we were debating House Bill 243. Is there further debate? Are you ready for the question? Stand at ease, Majority Leader.
Speaker, point well taken. So I place a call on the House.
Here's a call placed on the House. Stand at ease, waiting the satisfying of the call. I believe the call has been satisfied. Question before the House is the passage of committee substitute for House Bill 243, State Affairs. Members may proceed to vote. Clerk, lock the roll. Does anyone wish to change their vote? Clerk, tally the board.
37 yeas, 0 nays.
And so unanimously, the House has passed committee substitute for House Bill 243. Mr. Majority Leader.
Mr. Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent that the roll call vote on committee substitute for House Bill 243, State Affairs, be considered the roll call vote on the effective date clause.
And without objection, the roll call vote on the passage of the bill will be considered the roll call vote on the effective date clause, thus adopting the effective date clause. Madam Clerk, would you please read the next item of today's calendar?
House Bill 283 by Representatives Faith, Hines, Holm, Wolf, Whitaker, entitled An Act Relating to Limitations on Coal Leases. The Resources Committee considered the bill, attached a zero fiscal note recommending due pass Lynn, Gatto, Hines, Morgan, Massick, Wolf, and Fate. The report was signed by Fate, Chair. There's an amendment number one by Representative Berkowitz, beginning page one, line one.
Mr. Minority Leader.
I move Amendment 1. Objection. You know, Mr. Speaker, the other day we had a good, robust debate. It's about the most fun I'd had on this floor since I saw Terry Martin singing in a toga. It wasn't as ugly as y'all might think. But
I sure was.
My friend, the Judiciary Chair, said, "What's your plan?" Well, you know, everyone's been trying to squeeze pennies out of the sofa for the last couple of months, and what I have here, this amendment, because we're dealing with coal in the substance of the bill, this portion deals with carbon, and I thought the two were related because coal is really a string of carbon. So are diamonds. But anyway, carbon sequestration is an emerging market in the world. What happens is that companies that pollute elsewhere have signed various agreements that say that if you're going to pollute in one place, if you're going to add carbon to the atmosphere or to the ground, you have to take it out in another place. And through active management of Alaska's forests and even our ocean resources, reinjection, we can take carbon out of the atmosphere. We do take carbon out of the atmosphere. And people will buy our credits to do that. They will pay us to actively manage our forests. They will pay us to inject carbon into the ground. Now, before you think, okay, well, this sounds a little bizarre, it is bizarre. I don't really fully understand exactly what it means, but I do tell you what I understand. I understand that New Zealand sold its carbon sequestration rights for $70 million, that British Columbia, after the folks came here and we sort of indicated we weren't really particularly interested, the folks who were selling carbon credits went down to BC, and BC snapped it up and sold their carbon sequestration credits for
$400 million. That's the CBR amount that everyone has targeted. $400 million. We could have been well on the way. We could have secured $400 million of additional revenue this year had we acted promptly with carbon sequestration. It's a real thing. It might be beyond the knowledge and understanding of myself and many other people in this body, but that $400 million, that novel approach to resource development, exists. Now, the problem is if we don't act quickly, the amount we can get will be reduced. There's a finite amount of credits that people want to buy in the world. And as I understand it, approximately 70% of the credits have already been sold. Time is of the essence for us to act on carbon sequestration. I'm hoping my friend from District 32 will stand up and validate the wild assertions I'm making here now. But it's real money, and we ought to be moving promptly, because we can't afford to let $400 million just go away because we don't understand how to go get it.
Thank you, Mr. Minority Leader. Representative Fate.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I objected because this is about six pages that has not been reviewed by any committee, even though the subject might be a very worthy subject. It's really not germane to a simple piece of legislation such as is before you in 283. I have no problem with the topic that the Minority Leader so eloquently gave you, but this piece of this amendment should be a piece of legislation that should be heard and fully heard in the committee process. So I therefore oppose the amendment.
Representative Harris.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I want to pose a question to the maker of the amendment, which I find very interesting. I'd like to be able to support it, actually. I think, but to the maker of the amendment, has there been any contact at all, Mr. Speaker, to any of the different agencies that are listed here as being members of this committee? And if so, what was their response to it?
Well, I actually spoke.
Mr. Minority Leader.
Thank you. I spoke directly to the governor about this proposal a couple months ago. So he's not expressly mentioned. I know members have spoken with people from DNR. My office has with some of the foresters. It's a real thing. You can come up to my office. I've got all kinds of pamphlets that have been produced by state agencies that talk about carbon sequestration. Down in the Kenai, it could potentially be huge to help with the spruce bark beetle and development of logging there. It's a pro-development concept. So the people that are aware of it, I have directly had conversations with, but some have already printed out publications on the subject. They like it. It's a good thing.
Representative Hawker.
Mr. Speaker, the concept presented in this amendment was brought to my attention by probably one of the most influential constituents that I have. That would be my wife. And, you know, with her guidance, that's who I always take her guidance. And frankly, it is. It's a great idea. Its time might come. It is something I do recommend us look at. Great idea. Lousy amendment. Needs time in committee. Thank you.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'm sure this might actually pass, but if it doesn't, there is something to consider on this program, and that is there's a finite time and there's a finite amount of these available, these credits available. And I think if we don't take it up this year, I think it's our ability to cash in on these, is diminishing. So it should be something that we deal with. It is an opportunity out there. There is a big educational curve for all of us on this because it seems to work in strange and mysterious ways. But there are people out there in this state, in this community, in this resource development community in Alaska that look at this and go, and this needs to be done. We can actually do very positive things with this in the state of Alaska.
Thank you, Representative Guttenberg. Representative Kurtula.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I've been wandering in and out of the Minority Leader's office this session and looking at these huge books on this topic and been a little bit nervous to even ask about what the heck it was. But similar to one of the other speakers, I went home one night, and, you know, I think I have some pretty good ideas, and I'm really proud of the work I do, and, you know, I keep going and keep going. Well, I got at home, and my husband says to me, wow, did you see what the
member to my right, has done. He's got carbon sequestration. And it is that kind of excitement and that kind of leadership and that kind of thinking that's really going to get us moving forward in this state. And I want to thank the minority leader for having that kind of ability and for putting forward these ideas. So I support the amendment. I think it's a great idea. I think we should start, and this is a good place to do it. And with apologies to the original bill sponsor, because his bill's great, too. Thank you.
Is there further debate? Is there still an objection maintained on amendment to amendment number one?
Mr. Speaker, I was having you all on a little bit, actually, because I've spoken with the sponsor of the bill, who just happens to be the chairman of the committee in which this carbon sequestration bill is being sequestered. And, and he has given me every assurance that the bill will have a full and fair hearing. And I just want to take advantage of this opportunity to let people know there are other things out there that we can do and should be doing. And I look forward to having the hearing as quickly as we can, which under the 24-hour rule could be any time now. So I would be withdrawing the amendment at this time and look forward to getting unanimous consent on the bill when it's here.
Thank you, Mr. Minority Leader. I was looking forward to voting with you on First Amendment of the year. Madam Clerk, are there further amendments?
I have no further amendments.
In that case, Mr. Majority Leader.
I move and ask unanimous consent that House Bill 283 be considered engrossed, advanced to third reading, and placed on final passage.
Without objection, we are in third reading. It is... Madam Clerk, please read the title for third and final time.
House Bill 283, entitled An Act Relating to Limitations on Coal Leases.
At this point, we are going to recess until 5 p.m. to allow the chair of the Judiciary Committee to hear the backlog of bills that she currently has. But prior to doing the recess, I would like to move down the calendar to committee announcements so that members of the public will have an idea of what will be calendared in the various committees tomorrow, rather than to do this at 7 o'clock tonight. So it's just an opportunity for the public to be aware. So under committee announcements, under the 24-hour rule, are there committee announcements? Representative Wyrock.
Well, State Affairs is going to hear HJR 9 and bills previously heard.
Representative Masick.
Due to the session being at 5, there will be no transportation today.
Transportation is canceled today. Representative Fate.
Yes, we were planning to hear HB 267, which is the railroad bonds. We're going to try to get to HB 277, today, if we can possibly do that. So those are going to be two major pieces that we will try to be hearing.
Briefies. House, please come back to order. Under committee announcements, Representative Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. House Finance will meet tomorrow. These bills aren't listed in the way that they will be heard. But in HCR 21 Alaska Energy Policy Task Force, House Bill 210 Chitna Dipnet Fishery, House Bill 245 Suits and Claims Military Fire Defense, House Bill 251 Marine Pilots for Foreign Pleasure Craft, Senate Bill 173 Science and Tech, and bills previously heard at 8:30 a.m. tomorrow.
Finance, 8:30 tomorrow morning. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Community Regions Affairs will be meeting. There will be a time change, 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hines.
Thank you. Economic Development, International Trade and Tourism is canceled this evening, but we will meet tomorrow evening at 5:15, room 124. We will hear House Bill 300 and House Joint Resolution 28.
And the titles to both of those? The titles? Representative Williams.
I'm sorry, Mr. Speaker. Also, 205, House Bill 205, Permanent Fund Peace Corps Volunteer.
Representative McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Judiciary is meeting today at right after we get done here, so probably 1:20, and we'll continue with our regularly scheduled day. And then we're going to recess to the call of the chair because we're still working on what times the members can meet tomorrow, but we will be meeting tomorrow and Friday. We'll be meeting every day of the week. And, Mr. Speaker, it's our intent to simply roll the calendar over. So, for example, we have Senate Bill 41, SJR 5, House Bill number 244, House Bill number 157, HJR 26, HJR 9, HJR 20, House Bill number 145, and HJR 4. So whichever of those we do not get moved out today, we'll be taking up tomorrow. Thank you.
Representative Hines.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. HJR 28 is House Joint Resolution regarding the Republic of China, a resolution admitting them to the World Health Assembly. And House Bill 300 is rescinding ELF.
Thank you. Representative Fate.
Yes, my apologies, Mr. Speaker. I did forget to mention the time today. It will be at 1:30.
Resources, 1:30 today. Further committee announcements? Okay. Then at this time, we will take a recess until 5 p.m. Prior to the recess, we were taking up House Bill 283. We're in third reading under debate.
An announcement.
But prior to that, we'll move down the calendar to announcements. Mr. Minority Leader.
Thank you very much. This morning, I relayed to the body what was going on with our friend Reggie Jewell, and I'd like to give you all an update. He spoke with me just a couple hours ago. If I hadn't known that he was in the hospital, I wouldn't have known. He sounded his normal self. Told me that he hoped to be back with us in just a few days, and he didn't say it, but because I know he's thinking about it, and because those of us in the minority agreed that we would support the interests of his district, we vowed that we would continue to remind the co-chairs of finance about Shishmaref.
Representative Kukesh.
On that note, Mr. Chairman, I talked to Reggie, and he's got his sense of humor yet. He said, all of you know that he had a heart attack, and he said the voters of Alaska now know that he has one, and the rest of us are still suspect.
I wouldn't encourage everyone to go out and have heart attacks. The power of prayer obviously worked. Back up the calendar under, in third reading on House Bill 283, under debate, Representative Fate.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. 283 is a small bill with only basically two word changes. And those word changes simply expand the amount of acreage from approximately 48,000 square feet, about two townships, to four townships. And that's all there is to it. The reason behind this is because the federal government is now allowing much more land to be developed and for coal. A lot of the nations around the world still use coal. As a matter of fact, a very high percent do. To compete with this new opening process by the federal government for coal exploration and development, the Alaskans are going to have more coal acreage so that they, too, are able to find the coal and compete, because this acreage doesn't have to be contiguous. And if they can find and explore for that coal a tidewater, it will make it much easier for them to compete with the lower 48 states, where they already have a lot of transportation infrastructure. Now, this is a win-win situation, because not only does the state get more money from more leasing, but it also encourages new people on the block to come in and start exploring for coal. Coal is still a very vital energy source. And so with that, Mr. Speaker, I would hope that everybody would join me in voting for this piece of legislation.
Thank you, Representative Fate. Is further debate? You're ready for the question. The question before the House is the passage of HB 283. Members may proceed to vote. Clerk, lock the roll. Anyone wish to change their vote? Clerk, tally the board.
34 yeas, one nay.
And so the House has passed House Bill 283. Madam Clerk, Mr. Majority Leader.
Speaker, I would have an excused absence, so I would move and ask unanimous consent that Representative Moses be excused from the call of the House for the rest of the day.
Without objection, unless the Minority Leader is objecting to Representative Moses.
I would just like to ask that the Finance Committee be excused as well, because we have nobody left.
And Mr. Speaker.
So noted. Without objection, Representative Moses will be shown as excused from the call of the House.
And for personal family reasons, I would move and ask unanimous consent that Representative Wyrock be excused from 6:36 p.m. tonight until 11:46 p.m. tonight.
Without objection, Representative Wyrock will be shown as excused from the call of the House beginning at 6:36. Madam Clerk, please read the next item on today's calendar.
CS for Senate Bill 49, State Affairs, by the Senate State Affairs Committee, entitled An Act Making Corrective Amendments to the Alaska Statutes as Recommended by the Revisor of Statutes and Providing for an Effective Date. The State Affairs Committee referral is waived. The Judiciary Committee considered the bill, recommending do pass Samuels, Holm, Guerra, McGuire, Gruenberg, Ogg. The report was signed by McGuire Chair. There are no amendments, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Majority Leader.
Mr. Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent that the committee substitute for Senate Bill 49, State Affairs, be considered engrossed, advanced to third reading, placed on final passage.
Without objection, we are in third reading. Senate Bill 49, State Affairs version. Madam Clerk, would you please read the title for the third and final time?
CS for Senate Bill 49, State Affairs, entitled An Act Making Corrective Amendments to the Alaska Statutes as Recommended by the Revisor of Statutes and Providing for an Effective Date.
Under debate, Representative McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Before I speak to the bill, I want the body to note that Pam Finley is behind me here in the Elizabeth Paratrovich Gallery. She is our Revisor of Statutes, one of those unsung heroes here in the Capitol, making us look better and doing a lot of hard work behind the scenes. So it is her work that is contained in the CS for Senate Bill 49. And Mr. Speaker, as you well know, but there are new members that may not, the revisor's bill comes out every year. It's required by statute, and it is to be prepared and submitted to the Legislative Council under AS 105036. Its purpose is to clean up the statutes, Mr. Speaker, and to address technical issues that have either been brought to the attention by members of the body or the other body, or by interested persons in the private or public sector. But they're technical changes, Mr. Speaker. There are no policy changes of substantive matter contained in the revisor statute. We heard it in judiciary without controversy, and my committee aide has gone through it with a fine-tooth comb to make sure that no one slipped in anything as may have been done in years past. So with that, we have before us today a clean revisor's bill and a lot of hard work that's gone into it. I appreciate members' support.
Thank you, Representative McGuire. Mr. Minority Leader.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Just a quick question. I noticed it's a CS. I'm curious to know what amendments were made in the other body, what they added or deleted.
House Standard. Prior to the addies, we were under debate on Senate Bill 49. Question was posed to the carrier of the bill, what changes there might have been made. I think Representative McGuire has the answer.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Speaker, and I apologize. It's been a long day, and I didn't have that memorized. In answering the minority leader's question, in sections 38 through 44,
What we have there, Mr. Speaker, is that there was a change in 1996 that allowed documents to be referred to as either by book and page or the serial number, and there were still some outdated references to only book and page. The concern was raised by the AG's office that they were using serial numbers in some cases, and so what you have in sections 38 through 44, which were amended in the Senate, is an update to make it clear that in every reference to book and page, it can also be the serial number.
Thank you, Representative McGuire. So are we. Further debate. Question before the House is the passage of committee substitute for Senate Bill 49, State Affairs. Members may proceed to vote. Clerk, lock the roll. Does anyone wish to change their vote? Clerk, tally the board.
36 yeas, 0 nays.
And so the House has passed. Committee substitute for Senate Bill 49, State Affairs. Mr. Majority Leader.
I move and ask unanimous consent that the roll call vote on the passage of committee substitute for Senate Bill 49, State Affairs, be considered the roll call vote on the effective date.
Without objection, the roll call vote on the passage of the bill will be considered the roll call vote on the effective date clause, thus adopting the effective date clause. Madam Clerk, would you please read the next item on today's calendar?
CS for House Bill 191, Finance Amended, entitled An Act Relating to the Alaska Coastal Management Program and to Policies and Procedures for Consistency Reviews and the Rendering of Consistency Determinations under that program, eliminating the Alaska Coastal Policy Council, annulling certain regulations relating to the Alaska Coastal Management Program, and providing for an effective date. The bill's in third reading.
Under debate, Representative Fate.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. We've certainly massaged this piece of legislation, but I have a few other statements to make here. The Coastal Resource Service areas will remain intact. There's been a lot of literature flying on our desks here that seem to suggest that this will not happen, that somehow they will lose control. All coastal districts retain the same authorities and responsibilities as under the current program, including the same seat at the table for consistency reviews. That hasn't changed. And finally, the district enforceable policies remain applicable to all projects subject to a consistency review, and it's not just the Outer Continental Shelf or federal activities, but to all of those projects. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Representative Fate. Representative Katula.
If I hadn't stood up. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. You know, I came in this morning, and it seems like it was a million years ago now already, and I was thinking on my way in what I could possibly say to try to encompass the depth and breadth of this program and the similar depth and breadth of the legislation before us. And it's fairly daunting, but I'm going to give it a try. In 1972, the federal government embarked on a great experiment. It decided that because of the interest in its coastline and because of the coastal states and because of the unique things that we're involved in Alaska more so than any other state, we have twice the coastline of any other state and rely so heavily on our coastline. The federal government decided that if states built a coastal management program that dealt with activities and projects that impacted that coastal line, that it would allow the states to share power with it, that it would allow the states to participate in have a say in federal projects and activities that affected the state's coastline. Now, this is important. This is a states' rights issue. This is critical to Alaska. We were one of the few states that has active OCS lease sales, where we have more federal land in our state than in any other state. We have a lot of federally permitted activities. We have fish. We have federal fish and wildlife. We have the Corps of Engineers. We have EPA. And we all know how difficult it is to deal with these federal agencies and what a burden they place on us when they don't understand our state's issues because they aren't here, largely. This
has proven critical to us at times. This state has stood up and fought the federal government using the Coastal Zone Act, and it's been an incredibly valuable hook for our state. The program that we built in 1977 and the program that we've been working under since does something similar between the state and local coastal districts across our state. What our act says is similar to the federal act. If you, coastal district, build a program that we can agree with, that we can accept, then we will give you a little bit of our power. It's like a pyramid. The feds grant some power to the state, and the state similarly grants some power to the local governments, so that we work together, we work in one process, and we all get to air our issues together. In the best of all worlds, this is the way it should be. We should be able to work these issues out together. Over the years, there have been growing pains, and many of you have been on this floor as we've put forward some very important changes and very broad changes to this program. We've changed how projects can be phased, how they can be brought forward in discrete phases rather than to have a decision made all at once, when that just isn't possible on many activities like oil and gas activities. You don't know everything up front. So we've allowed that. We've changed how we do oil and gas decision making under coastal management so that it makes more sense. And when I was an attorney general and worked for this program, wrote a decision that took the Coastal Policy Council pretty much out of the very contentious type of appeals on projects. They have a very different role now and one that's more in keeping with the program. But this year, we've seen an attack on this program like no other. This year, what we've seen is a bill that will completely change this program and completely threaten the local part of this program, the way that the coastal districts interact on projects that affect their district. Right now, local governments' voices are heard, and they're heeded through this program to a certain extent. Projects that impact districts go through a review. People have a right to be at the table and to help make the decisions that impact them. Through district programs, things that are very important to those districts are implemented. For the member from District 40, things like seasonal drilling restrictions are implemented because of the migration of the bowhead whale. Seismic controls are implemented, again, to protect the bowhead. On the Kenai, we have offshore mining allowed specifically through the program, but it's balanced with fishing interests and other concerns for that area. Here in Juneau, we run our wetlands program, and if you've noticed, we've got a lot of them, luckily. We run our wetlands program through our coastal management program, and that's critically important because the Corps of Engineers controls the wetlands. If we don't have the coastal management program, we're going to lose control. We're not going to be able to say, here's where development makes sense, here's where it doesn't make sense. I have a great deal of respect for the speaker who spoke before me. But while it's true that CRSAs and districts will remain, they will not have the same power. And the sections of the legislation in particular that I'd like you just to take a look at are Section 14, which deals with enforceable policies, and will require every district to rewrite their policies, and will create a test that, when I was thinking of how to describe it, all that kept coming back to me was, this is like the rich man trying to go through the eye of the needle, and you never make it. It's practically impossible. When we've asked to have policies that currently exist shown to us, you know, what will survive this test, we were given policies that were rewritten, and when I asked, well, what are the changes that have been made to make it pass this test, I didn't get an answer. I'd also like you to take a look, the one last major issue I'm going to bring up, at Sections 21 and 11. The problem with these sections is that this is exactly the opposite from streamlining. These two sections together, along with actually Section 14, remove the Department of Environmental Conservation from this process, because DEC becomes the exclusive right over air, land, and water quality standards. A district will no longer be able to have a policy that deals with DEC standards unless it can somehow make it through that eye of the needle. We've tried to save ourselves on the Outer Continental Shelf through Section 11 and the application of DEC, but other than that, it's out. It's outside the process. It's outside the district enforceable policies. It's very difficult, and there are no promises that it's really going to work at all. You know, it's not just the districts. It's not just the state. It's not just even the federal government that play in this process. It's our developers. It's our oil and gas industry. It's our mining industry. The one thing that I have heard continuously is that developers rightfully want certainty. They want to have a process that will work. This is not that process. There is so much confusion throughout this legislation, so much difficulty in understanding it, so much ability for misinterpretation, and that's just the beginning of it. To require coastal districts to go out to completely rewrite programs without any actual guidance on what they're going to look like at the end is going to throw this state's permitting system into a terrible spin. So, in conclusion, I do want to say I have really appreciated the latitude you've shown, Mr. Speaker, the other members of the body, your consideration of the people who, although they weren't allowed to come and testify in person in the final hearings, they were here in the galleries, and they visited you. And I would really appreciate it tonight when you vote on this, no matter how you vote, if you remember that when these people come back to you, if this bill passes, and tell you about the problems that they're having, about the lack of funding to create these new programs, about how they're losing control over what happens in their homes, that you will remember this and that you will listen to them and do something. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Representative Cotulla. Further debate? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, or Mr. Speaker. It's been a long day. I'd just like to say that, unfortunately, what we have is a bill that has gone awry. When this was first proposed, it was proposed as a streamlining bill, and that's what we heard in the Fisheries Committee. Although it was disjunctive and couldn't be well understood, it did eliminate the coastal districts and therefore streamline permitting by putting it all in DNR. What we have now under the current bill violates the entire streamlining idea because we now have a developer having to go to three separate permitting sections. First of all, DEC, those permits are all separate. DNR will have its regulations and permits, and whenever it issues a permit, it is automatically assumed to be consistent with a consistency review. And then the third thing is this bill provides that local ordinances are enforced. So all of those districts, those Title 29 cities and boroughs that have adopted their enforceable policies into ordinance will be applied. So a developer comes to the state to get a permit. He's got to go to DEC exclusively for those permits, which are not tied in at all to DNR, goes to DNR for the DNR permits. Then he goes out to develop, but guess what? The local zoning permits are established in this law as functional, and so the developer is too blocked. Exactly what we've been trying to get away from. We've been trying to streamline permitting, and we're not doing that. So I would just urge members to consider streamlining, and this should be put off until the interim when we can have time to devote with this and with the districts to develop a system that will truly work for development in the state.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This was an education for me. It was quite an experience. Coming into this, I understood that there were problems with the Coastal Zone Management Plan, and we heard many CSs. And we also heard people coming to testify on it that were testifying on a CS that was passed, and they didn't have an adequate opportunity to address their issues, considering they were representing boroughs and cities and municipalities around the state. So in the process of thinking about this, I couldn't figure out why this wasn't a stakeholder process. why the third floor did not gather the departments together and the coastal zone districts and sit down and work on something that everybody wants to work more efficiently and more productively. It seems like that would be the way of going about this, and that you would have everybody at the table and everybody would be able to participate and have say, and you would have something that was streamlined, especially under the guidance of the third floor, where there was a strong impetus to actually do something and accomplish something. But we didn't see that. And that was really frustrating to watch, not just from my perspective, but from the perspective of the people in the coastal zone districts around the state. We heard earlier from my neighbor in District 7 that we don't lose the districts, and we don't. What we do lose is the councils. There used to be the districts and a council of districts, and they interacted with the state, with DNR. But then the council's no longer there. It's just 38 separate districts and then DNR. It seems to be a disconnect right there. And having DEC outside of it as a outside of the whole thing really separates and really disjoints the whole process. Mr. Speaker, but in the bigger picture of things, in the way the state goes about its business, we heard in this body the junior senator from Alaska, who used to be a member here, say that Alaska has to do it right. We need to, when she's back in D.C. defending our positions, defending development projects, trying to get things done, people in the nation's capital need to have the assurances that the things we're doing in Alaska are being done right, that the considerations of all of its citizens and all of its natural resources are taking place when we start extracting our precious minerals and our precious energy that the rest of the nation needs. And when you start looking about some of the looking about at some of the legislations that we've passed this year, dealing with habitat, dealing with this bill, the Coastal Zone Management, dealing with DNR being the lead agency and some other issues, you have to know, you have to realize that the message back there is we are not doing it right. That when they stand up to vote and when they stand up to argue on the nation's capital, we're putting the question into their heads. Are they doing it right in Alaska? Are they representing all of our interests? And I think this bill puts a big question mark in front of a lot of people's heads, and the national media and other groups that want to see things not happen in Alaska are given quite a bit of latitude and quite a bit of ammunition to stretch that point. And that's one of the things that troubles me about this bill. I grew up, my career in Alaska, last 33 years, was in the construction industry, bringing Alaska's natural resources and energy to the market, and I'm concerned that there's other generations out there are going to have those same opportunities. And I'm concerned that legislation like this, with a philosophy of leaving people out of the process, truncating it and making it more complicated, and not streamlining it, is not the way to do the economic development that the governor worked so hard in his campaign to stress. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Representative Guttenberg. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The thing that disturbs me about this bill, more than the substance, is the silence that I hear in this body. It's the silence that I hear whenever the representative from District 3 stands up and makes the most logical point possible, the most factually based point possible as to why this is a poorly written bill. The silence that I hear when the representative from District 35 stands up and makes the most logical point possible, the most valid point possible to explain why this is not a good bill. The silence that I hear in response to those points. And I guess, as a freshman legislator, I'm not so good at not saying the things I'm not supposed to say. So I'm going to be not so good again. I'm reading between the lines, and I'm listening to the silence. And what I hear and what I see is a bill that the administration wants, that the governor wants so badly. But that those who are going to end up voting in favor of this bill really don't care all that much about. Or if they do care much about it, we certainly haven't heard why they care much about it. There have been statements from the administration that this bill should be rushed through. I think that's why there was no public hearing on Monday when all the members